Let us see where we get to. Yeah. Am I sounding okay, Anna? Got an echo. Are you there, Anna Maria? Buenas tardes. Can you hear me okay? Good. Okay, well, let's hope it stays that way. Right, so, somewhere in here. So, any questions about dear old Percy? Or not very old Percy, dear young Percy? No? Have you managed to read the three poems? Two poems. Okay, what would a biographical approach to Ode to a Skylark look like? Or, if you prefer, what do you know about Percy Bysshe Shelley? He was married to the author of Fabius, not the mother. Yes, he was married to Mary Shelley eventually, after leaving Harriet Shelley. Anything else? Interesting, I didn't know that. Okay, fair enough. Was he expelled from Oxford? I don't know, was he expelled from Eton? Yeah, I think he only spent a term at Oxford before being expelled for promoting atheism. Eton, yes, I mean, he was known as Mad Shelley at Eton because of his radical ideas. If you're going to have radical ideas, Eton College is probably not the best place to have them, since it's has for several centuries been the most sort of establishment secondary school in the country. So when Shelley went to Oxford, his father assured him that he was prepared to provide for any number of illegitimate children, but he was not prepared to tolerate a misalliance. So he could have as much irresponsible sex as he liked and have lots of bastard children, but his father was not going to accept him marrying somebody who was not appropriate for him, which of course is the one thing he did twice, basically. I think, yeah, my general feeling about Shelley is he's very, very sort of adolescent all of his life. And there's a lot of sort of rebelling against parents and things like that. I find it really hard to be nice about Shelley. I think he would have been incredibly annoying. I probably would share some of his politics, but still, I think he's probably quite annoying. Anyway, he treated women pretty awfully all of his life. And the more we actually discover about his life, the more we see that he treated women very badly. When there's a comparison with Wordsworth, for example, Wordsworth actually behaved very well for the times, although the sort of his reputation when he was in France is sort of bad. He was actually much, much better behaved than Shelley was. But we should probably understand that behaviour within this context. I mean, if your father is telling you that, probably that doesn't help. He had an aristocratic attitude to sex, basically, dressed up as free love. Of course, free love is absolutely meaningless in an age before Salinger and birth control, effective birth control. Free love is free love for men, not for women, basically. Moreover, Shelley seems to have seen no inconsistency between his virulent denunciation of privilege and oppression and all of those types of things of the common people and his readiness to exploit his aristocratic status. So basically, he used the prospects of the fact that he was going to inherit wealth eventually to accumulate debts and expenses all the way across Europe. Basically, the idea was still, if you have an aristocratic name, and probably it even helped in continental Europe that he was British, and obviously Britain was quite powerful especially after the defeat of Napoleon. It would be quite normal to get to have a bill in a shop or whatever, or a hotel, etc. And he left a trail of bills all the way across Europe, basically. So not very responsible. Percy was living the contradictory situation at this time of the fact, of course, that aristocrats were not supposed to work. You wouldn't be considered respectable if you actually worked. And the fact that he was an idealist meant that he found it difficult to ask his father for money and therefore sort of put himself in his father's power. And so the only alternative was to just run up debts with ordinary working people and shopkeepers and people like that. Of course, what would have been truly radical for him to do would have been to get a job, but he didn't think of that. From June to early August 1820, the Shelleys were house-sitting in the Livorno house of John and Maria Gisborne. Mary Shelley notes in her diary that in a field near the Gisbornes' home, Percy was inspired one summer evening by the singing of a skylark. So it's possible, even likely, that this is sort of directly inspired in a real experience. Mary also mentions the fireflies, which she calls in the poem glowworms, in the fields nearby. Moreover, some years later, in 1827, John Gisborne also mentioned the field which was popular with skylarks. He refers to an infinite variety of gaudy, delicate, and odorous flowers, which seems to compare well with verse 11. So, to a large extent, hello, nice to see you too. Do you have any questions about Shelley? Nobody's asking any questions about Shelley, but anyway. We managed to prepare the two poems? Okay, no worries. You have something to look forward to at home. That's me being sarcastic about Shelley. No worries. The important thing is that you do it before the exam, unless Shelley comes up in the PEC, in which case you have to do it earlier. I know it's difficult to keep up. No worries. Okay, so what do we know about Shelley and the Shelleys at this time, at the time of writing this poem? What do we know about the Shelleys' life around this time of writing this poem? Is it 1819 or 1820? I thought 1819 was the visit to the Gisborne's house. Yeah, it's 1819 is with the Keats stuff. I can't remember the Ode to the West Wind, quite honestly. Ode to the West Wind might have been 1819. If this Gisborne reference is of any importance, then it would have to be 1820, because that's when he was with them, or in their house, as it were. Probably didn't figure that importantly in his radar, because he was publishing things that made it much more important. Do you know anything about what was happening with them? Right. Okay, so generally speaking, it was not a happy time for them. He was suffering from the effects of a severe winter in Florence. Presumably a severe winter in Florence is not like a severe winter in England. But having said that, probably a little bit like in southern Spain and places, the houses are not very well prepared for cold weather, so that may have been a problem. William Godwin was pressing him for money that he had promised him. So he had promised money to William Godwin, his father-in-law, and of course that meant him getting money out of his father somehow, so he probably shouldn't have promised it. But Mary was frantic about this and was in continuous conflict with her stepsister, Claire Claremont, who may or may not have had some sort of relationship with Shelley, probably, possibly was also sort of in love with him, having already had a relationship and a child with Byron. It's all very complicated, these people. You could write a wonderful Culebron about these people in Italy, and it would all be true. But she was still traveling with them, which was basically the sort of pain of Mary Shelley's life, the fact that Claire was always around. Moreover, Mary and Percy were still grieving over the loss of their small children, Clara and William. Shelley may also have been affected by the death of the mysterious child known as Elena Adelaide Shelley, who had died in Naples. And we don't know who the mother was. The mother might have been a servant, or the mother might have been Claire. So, but obviously things were complicated. And they had also been the subject of an attempted blackmail, an attempted extortion by a servant called Paolo, who had, I don't know what he was trying to blackmail them about, but anyway. So money was a big issue. And I think sort of by this stage, Percy was being sort of unfaithful on a pretty regular basis to Mary. She was still very much in love with him. They might well have actually sort of formally separated if he hadn't died. The fact that he died meant that she could then pretend that he was wonderful for the rest of her life. But, I mean, quite clearly he wasn't at all. That was good that he died. Finally, the English reviewers have condemned his ideas and were not being very nice about his poetry. So, not so happy Shelley. What was the symbolism of flight at this time, and how was flight relevant to Percy specifically? Flight represents freedom. Good, 1 point. Imagination, okay. Was flight in any sense especially relevant at this time? People were very excited about birds. We have established that. This was also the time of the first hot air balloons. So people were actually, for the first time, being able to fly in some sense or other. Although effective controlled flight was still not really done. I mean, you got in the balloon and you ended up somewhere, that was about it. Shelley was interested in this. For example, in 1812, he had made a series of model hot air balloons, so presumably like a candle. And, you know, who does this? I think perhaps the Chinese do this. They have sort of candles that are with screens over the top, which they float into the air. Yeah, basically doing that sort of thing with propaganda. So. Young Shelley was spreading revolution across Britain using little hot air balloons. No obvious results, it has to be said. Flight was associated with what was immaterial, what was spiritual. In Babylonian and later Judeo-Christian culture, angels have wings. In folklore, fairies have wings, as we saw in Infant Joy. They're sort of two things potentially related, especially now, you know, moving into a sort of a romantic period when people are much more relativized Christianity, much more, you know, they're much less dogmatic about what to believe. Remember the ancient Greeks had said that the flies on a battlefield were the souls of the dead warriors. So the idea that flies, not a very nice idea, but the idea was that that flies, so ultimately flying creatures, could be associated with souls, which is what we have here, of course. So what is the specific symbolism of birds? If the Ifipodocente were to want to write a question relating different works that you've studied, the most obvious commonality between as many works as possible in this course is birds. We have birds with Gerald Manley Hopkins, birds with Coleridge, birds with Keats, birds with Shelley. There's a bird in Aurora Leigh. No bird in My Last Duchess. But yes, I mean, there's a lot of birds, of course, problem as well. So, but what are the associations of birds? True. So what have we seen so far in terms of... Okay, so the albatross could potentially be the Holy Spirit. What about birds' song? I don't think albatrosses sing, but nightingales and skylarks, they certainly sing. What are the associations of birds' song? Okay, can we be more specific? Since the ancient Greeks, birdsong has been associated with poetry. So we find that, for example, in Aristophanes and also in Callimachus. This association was continued by the Romans. We have it in Virgil, for example, and even the Anglo-Saxons had the idea that poetry and birdsong were related. In the 15th century, John Lydgate called birdsong natural and sincere. So if there's this idea, for example, associated with sonnets, that they're rather insincere, this is a sincere form of poetry. In the 17th century, comparisons between birdsong and poetry became even more frequent. Milton compared Shakespeare to a songbird warbling his native wood tones wild. Because one of the aspects which people were slightly obsessed about regarding Shakespeare in the 17th century was the fact that he was from a sort of rural or semi-rural background. So that's the idea that he was like a bird in the forest sort of thing. Andrew Marvell brought the two traditions together in the garden, with his poetry as his soul's expression being compared to a bird singing. In the 18th century, poets such as James Thomson and Robert Burns were invoking birds for inspiration instead of classical muses. So previously, the muse in the invocation had referred to some classical figure. In Milton, of course, basically his muse is the Holy Spirit, but now birds substitute both of those. Birdsong was naturally attractive to the Romantics as they valued spontaneous creativity, or at least they said they did. None of the poetry that we study is in any sense spontaneous. There may be a spontaneous idea, but the poetry is clearly worked on a lot. It's not just somebody writing down what they think like a teenager. Wordsworth picked up on the apparent invisibility of the source of birdsong in To the Cuckoo. Now, of course, we might think that a cuckoo and a skylark are sort of radically different. But it, once you are, what's the word? Once you're abstracting them, basically, it doesn't really matter what you're referring to. So Shelley's blithe spirit, bird thou never wert, sprite or bird, all that, is almost paraphrasing Wordsworth's O blithe newcomer, shall I call thee bird, or but a wandering voice, no bird, but an invisible thing, a voice, a mystery. So basically the same idea of like the different words. But of course the point of the nightingale is that it is sort of abstracted by the fact that it's in the darkness so you can't see it. The point of the skylark is that it flies so high that you can't see it often, and you can only hear it. So there you go. Why is the skylark a bird of unusual significance, and why does it have a special appeal to poets? What's special about skylarks? They fly very high. One point. Good. Okay. Anything else? Well, interestingly, there is no classical symbolism for larks. For some reason, the Greeks and the Romans were completely uninterested in or their poets were anyway. So the skylarks are only really dealt with in English poetry, so it's a very sort of English thing. Or British perhaps. In The Golden Tange, the Scottish poet William Dunbar, who was probably the greatest Scottish poet of the 15th century, described the lark as heaven's menstrual fine, so the poet of the skies. So there's an association there. Shakespeare and Milton used the lark as a symbol of spontaneous joy. So in Sonnet 29, Shakespeare wrote, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate. So again, all sorts of religious associations together with the idea of the bird. In L'Allegro, Milton talked about the lark's watchtower in the skies. This may have influenced verse 9, in which Shelley describes the lark as like a highborn maiden in a palace tower. So we have the idea of a tower, etc. in both cases. Again, so what we probably have is Shelley going for a walk, hearing this bird song, finding it beautiful, whatever, and then going back and checking all these references to build up a poem around it. It's not a spontaneous poem, really. The inspiration is spontaneous, but the rest of it isn't. James Hogg wrote a poem in 1816, so a couple of years earlier, called The Skylark, in which he called the bird blithesome and an emblem of happiness. And this may also have had an influence. Wordsworth starts his To a Skylark, which was written, I think it was started in 1805 and finished in 1815, with the lines, ethereal minstrel, pilgrim of the sky, dost thou despise the earth where cares abound? And a lot of the latter part of the poem is that contrast between one idea and the other. However, it all gets a bit complicated and incestuous because Shelley's poem also seems to have influenced Wordsworth's To a Skylark, written in 1825. So they're all constantly writing poems to birds, which included the lines, there is madness about thee, a joy divine, in that song of thine. Lift me, guide me, high and high, to thy banqueting place in the sky. Joyous as morning, thou art laughing and scorning. So we have the idea of the madness and the idea of scorning the earth and all of these types of things. So all sorts of context going backwards and forwards in that case. What other context do we have to this poem apart from specific references to the Skylark? No? Okay. There are some parallels with the poem On Paradise Lost by Andrew Marvell. Andrew Marvell wrote a poem about Paradise Lost. In Paradise Lost, book 9, Milson talked about his unpremeditated verse, and that idea may be behind where Shelley refers to unpremeditated art in the first verse. In what sense? Good. Okay.
The poetry is inspired by the
Right. But the usage of it, I think, is probably, we could say, different. Shelley's sort of wondering when he's going to change the world. And Keats is, you know, how can I live with this painful existence? So one of them is very much a sort of somebody wanting to fulfill their public role. And the other is just somebody trying to survive. So the actual usage is, I think, a different, but yes, there are parallels there. Good. However, the greatest influence on To a Skylark is from a man called, a Greek philosopher called Plato. Good. We got there. So Shelley had been reading Plato's Phaedrus, during the first half of 1820, and had read and translated Plato extensively, including Ion and Symposium, over the preceding couple of years. There is quite a lot of mystic mumbo jumbo in Plato's work, but the key idea as regards Shelley's poem is that he considered the soul as a winged spirit that soared on high. In fact, Plato describes how the soul grows feathers. So he's taking this very, very literally, slightly strange. Anyway, in Phaedrus, Plato conflates madness and poetic inspiration. And that concept has come to be known as furor poeticus. We can see that very much in evidence in this poem. Of course, that would be music to the ears of somebody who had been known as Mad Shelley. If being mad is being artistically inspired, then he's quite happy to be mad, basically. In Ion, Plato had stated that the poet is a light and winged and holy thing, which no doubt tied the poem into the whole bird as divine spirit thing in Shelley's mind. The praise of love or wine in verse 13 may be a reference to Plato's Symposium. How would you go about analyzing this poem psychologically? Okay. So in that sort of sense, we could definitely link it to a nightingale, as you suggested. Anything else? Okay, well, you can keep thinking about that one. How would you analyse the poem from an eco-critical standpoint? Okay, and there's probably an element of the oneness of being, so the fact that dumb animals can teach us things would be a very much of a romantic idea. What ambiguities exist in the poem? Yeah, sometimes his ideas escape him, as it were, and they get very confused. So, for example, he says that scorn, hate, pride, and fear, so I'm saying, you scorn, hate, pride, and fear, but hate, pride, and fear together add up to scorn. Yeah, so it's all a little bit weird. Sometimes, if you read carefully what he's saying, it makes you laugh because it doesn't really make any sense. Again, for me, this is one of the reasons why I see him as really very adolescent, basically. The bird is repeatedly associated with thought. But conscious thought is precisely what the skylark does not possess, as you were saying about death. T.S. Eliot archly claimed that he was unable to detect any meaning in to a skylark. More charitably, in The Armed Vision, S. E. Hyman described the poem as a messy but certainly understandable poem. So it's a bit chaotic in any case. What might a sensory interpretation of the poem be? Good. What's that? Right. Okay. So especially verses 8 to 11 have a sort of cascade of these synesthetic similes, which potentially you could see is quite clever, I suppose. So what is the poem about? Whatever. If you've got a question, describe the main themes of To a Skylark by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Anything to add? Okay, again. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in one sense, there's this idea that consciousness is a burden, is a karma, and it's consciousness which effectively is gravity, which is what keeps us on the ground, which keeps us earthbound. And so because the bird is not burdened by consciousness, it can, in its ecstasy, fly directly to heaven. What we're meant to do with that, I don't know, but that's sort of basic idea. Man, and specifically I think he is talking about men, on the other hand, is always looking before and after, and his thoughts wander through eternity, existing but in the future and in the past, being not what he is, but what he has been and what he shall be. That's a fragment from Shelley's essay of 1819 on life. So the idea that the fact that we're conscious means that we are not very good at living in the present. We're always thinking about what we're going to do, what's going to happen, and what has happened in the past. So basically, it's a session of mindfulness, which is that exciting. Indirectly, yes. I don't think so. I don't think it's really directly the case, because he's not sort of directly suggesting that, and he's getting as much frustration out of his interaction there as inspiration. I mean, obviously there's some inspiration. Okay, so what can we say about Ode to the West Wind? Did you manage to read through the exegesis? Did you read the exegesis on Ode to the West Wind? Right. Well, talk to me about it. What can you remember? Okay, so psyche and breath in Anglo-Saxon, all those types of things. Yep. Yep. Right. So, I mean, again, we could probably take a lot of that back to the tiger and Blake, and this idea of even Shiva, the idea of the destroyer and the creator being the same thing, probably ideas that we can also find in Frankenstein. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Well, how did you react? Was I being too cynical, you think? Was I being too cynical, or? But don't you find To Autumn much more sort of controlled? And I mean, To Autumn seems to be well structured, clear ideas, etc., whereas this is rather chaotic, and there's a tendency with firstly to overuse similes, and also a lot of mixed metaphors, and in the process of mixing them, things can begin to sound a little bit silly. I find anyway. I don't know what else to say about you. So? Yeah, well, and, I mean, the idea of the sort of, I mean, there's almost the idea of the Mediterranean urinating in itself, which is a bit strange. I find that a lot of the classical references are a little bit sort of forced and a little bit to sort of show that he knows something about these things rather than necessarily fitting very well with what he's talking about. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just being old and cynical, but I can't really get very excited about this. Well, I think so, but yeah, probably the whole idea of autumn, the beginning of autumn, but also, which again, according to what I say here, should have been not off more than, which is the south wind. I imagine that it's part of this slight tension there is between a particular experience and wanting to be faithful to that and the symbolism of things. And so, and I know of people having this problem when they're writing autofiction. They will tend to think, oh, I can't write that because it didn't happen like that. And it's like, you're writing fiction. You're allowed to break with what actually happened. But that creates a problem because you will have things which are contradictory in that sense. And if you are playing at the game of symbolism and you want to have, you know, that by just mentioning something, you're creating a huge amount of connotation, then if real life gets in the way, that's going to confuse people. And I think it does a little bit. I don't know. What questions do you think you could ask if you were asked to compare the use of the season here and in to autumn? Are they the same time of year? So, to autumn is basically late summer, whereas this is much more winter is coming. He had a lot of problems, but most of his problems were his own creation. And Keats had a lot of problems which were not his own creation. So that sort of makes sense. And Keats, in the poetry that we're looking at, knew perfectly well he was going to die and had watched people die of the same disease. So he knew exactly what phases he was likely to go through. Whereas Shelley died a few years later, but he wasn't so aware of, you know, the fact that he's got to die. Do you know anything about Shelley's death? Yes, but there's a possibility that the ship was attacked by pirates of some sort. It may be true, it may not be true. But although there was a storm on the lake. Was it on the lake or on the Mediterranean? It shouldn't have been enough to sink the ship. So it may have been a situation where people boarded the ship and killed them, as it were. But it's a boat, sorry, but it's not absolutely clear what happened. I think that Shelley's reputation would have suffered immeasurably if he had survived. Because a lot of it's a little bit like sort of Jack Kerouac or James Dean or somebody like that. A lot of the romanticism of Shelley is the fact that he died young, in these types of circumstances, having an adventure in Italy. You can't really romanticize in the same sort of way Keats's death. You can, of course, Byron's death, because he was supposedly about to lead the Greeks to independence. But dying young was a very good career for these people. So, how would you compare to a skylark to the use of the bird in the Rhymes of the Ancient Mariner? Yeah, try to think of essay questions there, and how could you structure those? The role of death in the bird is the exact opposite of that. I mean, in the albatross is Christ-like in that it's sort of sacrificed, whereas in the skylark and in the nightingale, the birds are in some sort of sense eternal. And so they're the opposite of that. Probably didn't. But yes, definitely. What was the date of the Ancient Mariner? I can't remember. Yeah, it was 17. So you're saying Shelley might be criticizing Coleridge. People like Shelley, because I mean, Shelley's poem is 20 years later. Right. It's interesting. I'll have to think about that. Another potential criticism along the lines of what you're saying is that if you have all of these people from Virgil and whatever to Shelley and on, giving symbolic weight to birds, that can lead simpler-minded people to do the same thing and therefore actually sort of kill the bird. That, I mean, somebody who had no perception of that poetic tradition would probably not think to worry that an albatross is controlling the wind or controlling the eyes or whatever it's going to be controlling. So, yes, that's quite interesting. Is there, I mean, to a large extent, I don't think it's very helpful to consider Don Juan as a particularly work of romanticism. So in terms of what you've seen, is there a clear distinction between first and generation romanticism? And if so, what is it? Should we consider these people one school or not? Why do you think that was? To become older and conservative, right? That's definitely a possibility. Any other reasons? Well, people like, especially Wordsworth, had the direct experience of the French Revolution. Whereas the French Revolution was sort of a little bit ancient history by the time that Shelley and people were writing about it. So it was much easier, I think, to romanticize it after the event. But the fact that they were, the works that they're writing, I mean, Wordsworth and Coe are quite young when they're writing most of the stuff we've looked at. But of course, they die much, much later than all of the younger generation. Can we talk about one romantic movement, or is this a little bit of a stretch? What is romanticism? What are the tenets of romanticism? On the individual, right? Why? Why? There's a certain tie in there with the values of bourgeois liberalism as well. The sublimity of nature, what does that mean? Why did that happen with these people? Right. Why did they feel that they lost touch with nature when Pope and Swift and previous people did not feel that in the same sort of way? Okay, there's the rise of industrialization. But, and that's quite a slow process. It's probably not a very perceptible process if you're actually living in it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. What do you mean when you say it was very conservative? Okay, I mean, in terms of political ideas, I'm not sure that we could necessarily say that the neoclassical poets were particularly sort of reactionary. And I mean, there's quite a sort of show of radicalism with this lot. As I say, I'm not sure that they were really doing anything particularly radical. Okay. And there's the whole concept of the rise of toil as compared to creative work, which obviously is a big theme for people like Blake. What other characteristics do we have of romanticism? So, sublimity of nature, oneness of nature. I guess spontaneity of feelings, although not in any real sense of poetry. Good. Right. Go on. What's a romantic novel? Is it though? Well, you say atypical, but apart from Frankenstein, could you name any other romantic novels? Above all poems. I mean, I think it's almost impossible to keep up the a romantic intensity over any long work. It just becomes too much, as it were. So, with Frankenstein, there's not the same sort of appeal to sublimity and these types of things. It's an adventure story, and there's certainly a lot of gothic elements, but I wouldn't personally consider it a romantic novel, because I don't think romantic novels are possible. And again, that's one of the reasons why Don Juan should probably be considered outside of this whole situation, because there's comedy, there's a lot of comedy in Don Juan, and these people don't know how to laugh, basically. There's not a lot of joy and just lightness about romanticism. Any other tenets? Medievalism. Where have we seen that? Thank you. Okay, whereas this, I mean, this certainly the past is the setting of the Ancient Mariner is possibly Renaissance type thing. So certainly looking backwards. Right. I mean, another thing that is often the case, not necessarily the case with any of the stuff that we've looked at, is poetry about ordinary people. So, I mean, the fact that The Idiot Boy by Wordsworth is about a child with Down syndrome, and there's an awful lot of poetry about very, very ordinary, rural people who were not really the subject of poetry before. In that sense, for example, Gray's Elegy can be seen as moving in the direction of romanticism. But we don't necessarily see much of that in the actual poems we've been studying. Right. Rather than sort of narrative. Right, but I mean, we, in terms of how many poems do we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. We have 12 poems, and of those 12 poems, 2 of them are narrative. And in terms of the number of, the size of the things, those two dominate all of the poems we've done. Neither of them, for me, is actually described as romantic works. Again, I can't really see it as being possible to write romantic narrative poetry. It might be romantic at the moment, but not much more than that. I always tend to be a little bit cynical about categories, but I'm slightly unhappy about the whole idea of the Romantics as a group of people. Clearly the greatest writer at this time was Jane Austen, who had nothing to do with them at all. The most popular writer of the time, Walter Scott, had really nothing to do with them at all. They were Gothic elements, but there's not really that. And they didn't really see themselves as a movement either. So that's a problem. I mean, Byron spent his time being very, very nasty about Wordsworth and Southey, and occasionally saying something nasty about Coleridge, but his main victim was Wordsworth. Shelley could be quite nasty about Wordsworth. Keats was a bit more respectful. Wordsworth and Coleridge were nasty about Blake, who was sort of very much an outsider of the whole thing. Byron was pretty nasty about Keats as well. So, I mean, although Shelley was friends with both Byron and Keats, there wasn't any real connection between Byron and Keats. I don't know. I would imagine they met, but there certainly wasn't any particular sort of strong feeling of fellow poets, etc. So the whole idea of this being a movement for me is a little bit, I'm not entirely convinced that it is. But, and it also sort of all bleeds into Victorianism. Victorian poetry is much easier to define because it's defined by the reign of Victoria. So it's a little bit like this sort of problem that we'll be looking at in half an hour's time about the whole definition of romances, this bloody word romance, and the way it causes so many problems studying literature, that it doesn't really hold water as a complete set. Be aware that the Equipo Docente are very invested in the preface of lyrical ballads, and in terms of the tenets of Romanticism as expressed there. Last year's PEC was, if I remember correctly, it was like the chapter on the preface of lyrical ballads in the Norton anthology. So, you can see the relationship there. But again, I mean, that for me is something which is slightly dubious, given that most of those ideas, even if they haven't been written down, are very much being used and expressed in Blake's poetry and Blake's letter. I've got to go to one more to say. Well, all the works in lyrical ballads don't abide by the rules. It's a problem. Some of them, yes. I mean, there's certainly, for example, the references, the sort of English references that you're likely to be, that are implied by Wordsworth, are not the same. I mean, especially as we've seen with Shelley, but a little bit with Keats, and certainly with Byron, the idea that you can refer back to classical, poetry is classical culture. You don't really get that in the first generation people, and you do get that with this lot. I think it's quite important to consider all of these people in terms of the historical moment, in the sense that because of the Napoleonic Wars and etc., the anti-revolutionary and then the Napoleonic Wars, Wordsworth most of the time wasn't able to travel. Obviously he'd gone at the time of the revolution, but most of the time he wasn't able to travel. Blake wasn't able to travel. Coleridge wasn't really able to travel. Whereas after the Napoleonic Wars, Keats and Shelley and Byron all were able to go to continental Europe and take part in that. And again, although Wordsworth had been doing this before war broke out with France, a lot of the renewed interest in British nature comes from the idea of this revolutionary act of walking, and specifically walking in Britain, and they're all doing that, except for Byron. So there is very much that idea that, I think it probably happens in most countries at most times. There's this sort of, you have waves of a huge great emphasis on foreign influence, and of course in those of these people who are aristocratic, there's the idea of a grand tour, the idea that they haven't been able to do a grand tour, and the importance of classical culture and European culture and all of these types of things. And then there's the feeling of people sort of, I don't know my own country properly. And so, part of that again is actually to do with modernization. You only traveled when you had to, before about 1750, because it wasn't very safe in Britain. In a lot of Spain, even into the 19th century. There were highwaymen and blah, blah, blah. That very much had sort of changed by this period, and it was much safer to just sort of be traveling around. And there was a need to travel around in Britain because you couldn't travel around continental Europe. So, Any other questions? Any other points you want to make? One last thing to say about Shelley Hammer. So you've both finished dinner, almost, and you have, right? Okay. So, and that will be, we'll do that in 2 weeks' time. Do you notice any relationship between Jane Eyre and the Romantics? With the Gothic, yeah. Perhaps more obviously. Mm-hmm. Right, I mean, there are some direct quotes from Romantic works, and a lot of the less silly ideas have been incorporated into Victorian literature by that time. I think you could. It would be possible to sort of separate, isolate out, and we'll see it when we see it. But romantic elements there, which are relevant and useful to think about. Well, the women's clothing was not very conducive to staying conscious at the time. Yes, the idea of sort of somebody trapped in the attic. I think it's the Sicilian, but I can't remember the Sicilian. One of them, novels definitely has elements that are clearly related there with this. That's certainly something I think which tends to be taken over in the Victorian period. They want to play both sides in the sense that it's attractive to have these sort of psychological things and fear and emotions, but directly sort of referring to ghosts and zombies and things is considered a little bit silly. So you can have people, young impressionable people, sort of being afraid of these things and then come out and explaining it in a Scooby-Doo sort of way. So definitely, yes. Did you notice any Gothic in your reading so far of Great Expectations? Treasure Island. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that first meeting in a graveyard, etc., is obviously all very Gothic, you know, at night, moonlight, blah blah blah. Have you gone to the Miss Havisham part or not?
No.
Yeah. Because I mean, that is all very very Gothic, it's all, I mean, she's sort of almost a life and death type figure. As I said, a lot of the Gothic literature of the 18th century is a little bit silly and a little bit immature, but mature Victorian novels really wouldn't have been possible without that Gothic precedent to use as a sort of core. To get ideas there. Yeah, and there's also a moment where She sees herself in the mirror and doesn't recognize herself. I think even more than once. Yes, mirrors are very important. The director of studies of the course wrote a book about mirrors in 19th century literature. So, I mean, it's like it is a very clear theme. Basically, what happened is that there were mirrors earlier, but mirrors are not very good. So it's a little bit like a fairground mirror with distortions. And the mirrors were very expensive. Around this time, they invented a new process for putting silver paint, basically, on the back of glass and creating much better flat mirrors much more cheaply. And so mirrors, a little bit like in the sort of huge progress there was in clockmaking in the first half of the 17th century, and you can see people's attitudes to time changing. You get the same sort of thing here. What about the cultural references? How have they changed over the Romantic period? So, if we've had moments of referring back to classical culture, Greco-Roman culture, referring periods of, especially the Gothic period, of not wanting to do that. How are the cultural points of references changing in the expanding, if you like, over this period? Right, but I mean, that process starts with things like the way of the world. So there definitely is, and there's a lot more to be proud of than Chaucer wasn't in a position to sort of talk proudly about English literature because there really wasn't very much. That's clearly not the case, but that's not the case by the beginning of the 18th century, much less so by the end. Which cultures are being referred to significantly for the first time? Well, the British inferiority complex with France is older. I mean, there's a lot of references to French literature in Restoration comedy, for example. Restoration comedy is largely an imitation of French. Okay, so I mean, there are revolutionary ideas coming in from France. Other than France? What are the earliest works that we could consider literature in America? You've studied this more than I have, but I mean, I get the... What date are we talking about there? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but what date? Yeah. Well, it sounds like that. I'm not sure there is much influence going back towards England from that. I mean, there is obviously increasingly so as the century progresses, but I would say much more in the second half than in the first half. I was actually thinking more of Germany, both in philosophical terms and directly in terms of literature. But also, the East, specifically India, which we've seen above all in the Tiger. But there is a valuation of sort of non-European culture, which, and obviously German literature is European culture, but in a way that is relatively new. So that's related to the translation of works from Sanskrit and the decoding of Sanskrit, etc. But also the whole idea of the enormity of Indian culture. And I think, especially with these more radical people, there is quite clearly an understanding that Indian culture was perhaps a little bit decadent and was not militarily on a par with European culture, but that was only militarily, really. In terms of architecture, the influences were going towards Europe than towards Britain in terms of painting the things, it's also, there's an element of it traveling in the other direction. And there's a big sort of fashion for all things Indian and all things in the slightly Eastern. So that you have this process of orientalism. And you will see that, for example, also his real travels in places like Turkey and Albania, and the sort of sexual freedom that he would have in those types of contexts. But I mean, also the clothing and stuff. I mean, people were dressing up in that sort of way. So there is sort of this idea that non-European cultures have things to offer and things to learn from, and actually can, be a source of inspiration. I think probably much more so at this point than in the Victorian phase. In the Victorian phase, people by that stage are much more sort of, for want of a better word, white supremacist in their mindset. But of course, it's quite difficult to actually judge how people's concepts of these things actually work. I mean, as we will see with Jane Eyre, there is a post-colonial interpretation of Jane Eyre, which sees it as this terrible racist work, which really does not stand up to any analysis. And again, I mean, things like Heart of Darkness next year, you will see, is attacked as a racist work by some people, very unfairly, in my opinion. But that interaction with the world, I think, is becoming more and more important, just because the world has got smaller, because people are travelling all over the place. I mean, a lot of British people are going to India and dying like flies, so the mortality rate amongst the British in India, until, I would say, the sort of early 20th century was appalling. I mean, a lot of them would last months before they were dead. So there was a lot of, you could make a lot of money and this type of thing, but it's a strange sort of experience, going to India. By the time that it can be a sort of holiday type situation, it's, you know, as described in things like Passage to India, which you'll look at next year, that's talking about the beginning of the 20th century rather than, this time it's a problem. I mean, you remember I mentioned with Blake about the general's son who was killed by a tiger. His other son was killed by a shark in the Indian Ocean. So, I mean, they must have had an idea of sort of, a different idea of nature, shall we say, than we did. Yes, more red nature. Okay, right, well, I think we can leave it there. Sorry, I sort of ran out of steam today, but I will be more enthusiastic about buying, I promise. It's easier to be enthusiastic about that. So, you've got the sort of plan over the coming weeks, but we will do Byron next week, Jane Eyre the following one, and then Tennyson, which is Yeah. So, well, it's, you could call it Lord Byron, but basically it is Don Juan. It's just the bits of the book, most of book one of Don Juan. So it's not the whole of Byron. Byron does write some romantic poetry, but what we started Don Juan come up really with is romantic poetry. And he's, Byron is perfectly capable, Byron's capable of being cynical about pretty much anything, but he is, in Don Juan, he's being pretty, he's laughing a lot about romanticism. So, as with all of this, he's going to be slightly careful with the labels. But anyway, we will see that. Okay, then. I hope I'm feeling, I'm full of drugs from, Tramadol. So, it's all sort of, everything's slightly fuzzy. It's a very bad time of year. Bye-bye, people online, if any of you are still there.